Hello, everyone. My name is William Bieletta, and I am with 1180 WFYL working for your liberty. Today, I am joined with Chuck Mason here at the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference of 2024, and he is the author of the book, How Do I Talk to My Kids About Social Justice? Welcome, Chuck.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Will.
Good. All right. And before I begin, just getting into the questions about your book, just would like to ask you, how did you get into this philosophical aspect of the evangelization that you've been talking about?
After I was out of college, you know, really praying about what direction God was really taking me, I wanted a better biblical education. I wanted a deeper theological education. I really felt called to Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California.
Mm-hmm.
So I started an MDiv program, which is complete pastoral training, but I knew I wasn't called as a full-time pastor.
Right.
But about halfway through the program, they required me to take a course in philosophy.
Okay.
You know, just as a,
yeah.
You know, and I stumbled into postmodern philosophy, and we could see what was going to happen within culture at that point, and I became utterly fascinated with it. So I'm very much fascinated by how ideas work. How do we as a society choose the foundational concepts that really define who we are, what we do? How do we decide what is acceptable or unacceptable in society? You know, how do we order our society? What is justice? What is fairness? So I just became fascinated with it and wanted to, and that's kind of my life's ministry, my life's passion.
Oh, well, that's definitely a good calling to be called to philosophy and that aspect of the faith. So my next question for you is, I mean, obviously your book is entitled How Do I Talk to My Kids About Social Justice? But really, can you just sum up that book in maybe a couple of sentences, or just really just sum it up into a point where we can then kind of pick it apart, if that's possible even? But really, how do parents talk to their kids about social justice?
Well, that's a process that involves basically three different strategies. But I watched the social justice narratives impact my own sons. And I had to step back and apply all of the apologetics and all, you know, what I had learned while I was at Fuller with my own kids. So the book is really kind of my journey with my own sons to get them off of woke. And I just condensed it down into a kind of a handbook for parents so that they could deal with the impact of social justice narratives on their children.
Okay. Well, so the book in general, that's about kind of putting it into perspective, I would assume, just social justice in general. But what perspective does it take social justice on? Does it take it from the perspective of social justice as a societal issue, or does it take it from the perspective of a family-oriented point of view?
Well, it comes at it from a family-oriented point of view, because it's all about protecting your kids from the woke indoctrination that they're receiving in public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book breaks down basically how LGBTQ, critical race theory, and cancel culture, how they formed, how the ideologies work, and what parents can do. But the book stresses relationship building with your own children and how critical it is that you're maintaining good, healthy communication, good, healthy, connected relationship with your children, and how that becomes the stepping stone for the conversations that you can have where you can begin to use strategies to challenge the impacts of the ideologies with kids. So if you use the strategy of the book, you'll be able to show how the ideologies really are failing and how they break down and allow kids to process information and to recognize how they're constructed and the negative impact they have on society and even their own kids, your own kids' lives.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily the most familiar person with social justice. So I think for me, so when I hear social justice, the first thing that I think of is it being something where it's a narrative that's being pushed by the left and
100%.
Yeah, obviously.
100%.
Can you maybe like break down what exactly social justice is in a more basic sense?
Sure. So coming from the church, we have based our concept of justice on God's righteousness as it comes through the Judeo-Christian worldview that's really informed Western culture, Western society in America.
Right.
Social justice comes at a concept of justice through the lens of Marxism. It looks at society as being constructed to enable exploitation, oppression, and victimization, and set up to enable and to protect that. So it sees any difference in outcome, any disparity between races or between wealth or along those lines as being basic exploitation. So justice is not about our biblical understanding of justice. Social justice says we need to reorder society to achieve fairness, this equity. If we can create equal outcomes for people, then that's going to bring on this essentially utopia on earth and save humanity on an earthly sense. So social justice wants to use society to bring about a level of fairness that they think brings an earthly salvation.
Okay, so it's a utopian style of thinking of
justice. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And the way that you go about it in your book, you mentioned how you were dealing with this with your own children, mm-hmm. and how you had to utilize some of those things that you were taught at Fuller. So if you could kind of go into what problems you were seeing specifically with your children, maybe that would be helpful.
Yeah. So I'll walk you through kind of the point of this that I went through with both of my kids and how it worked. Just let me know if I get a little too convoluted here.
You're okay. Fine.
So here's how the journey went from Fuller. I got a basic understanding in postmodern philosophy.
Okay.
And when you see what Western philosophy, the Enlightenment was, and then postmodern philosophy, you understand how philosophy works.
Right.
Which allowed me to break down Marxism and then the social justice narrative.
Awesome.
Okay. So I was able to see how they were constructed and how they functioned. And when you know how they're constructed and function, then you can use the points of those positions against themselves.
Yeah.
Now, it's critical. So there are two things you need to do if you're a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or if you're anywhere in society, if you're at a school board meeting, if you're in your workplace, you can use this strategy wherever. So you have to have at least some level of good conversational relationship with somebody. And you have to understand how the ideologies work.
Right.
So this is how this worked. So we'll start with the transgender issue, because my sons came home, and particularly my older son, because he was just starting high school. My younger son was a couple years behind, but he was kind of following Big Brother's lead and whatnot. So my oldest son came home. We were driving home in the car. I picked him up home from school, and he's talking about how a friend of his is transgender. He's a boy. He's identifying as a girl, and that was a good thing, and he was coming out. You know, my son was going, you know, this is a good thing. And as a parent, you're like, whoa, you know, let's put the brakes on this.
Right.
So yeah. I reacted like most parents.
Right.
And you try to control a conversation because you want to move your child out of that into a place that you know they're more conservative, more towards the gospel. But if you try to move your kids by saying no and this, mm-hmm. they're just going to push back. And I was watching the sparks fly. So what I did was I started with how the transgender ideology works.
Mm-hmm.
There are two things that are central to this. And these are part of the transitions we're seeing in our culture. The first is we're becoming a post-truth society.
Right.
Which means that feelings, emotions, and preferences are more important for determining what's real than facts, okay, data, and rational thought and science.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is the left today relies on a theory of blank slate social conditioning. They say that biology has no impact on things like gender or race mm-hmm. or anything, that everything is socially conditioned. So society creates a concept of gender. And they could define whatever female mm-hmm. is.
Right.
So what happens is society creates a concept, a person affirms it based upon their feelings and their preferences and desires. Okay? And so that is how gender is constructed today, how a young teenager boy can say that I'm female, I'm a girl.
Right.
So what I did is I used the standard apologetics tactic, which is you have to use questions.
Right.
Okay? Questions are crucial. Because what you can do with a question is you can get somebody to see your point of view without forcing it on them and causing them to react. So if I asked you a question, in order to answer that question,
right.
you're forced to listen to everything in that question, consider the position
right.
so that you can formulate an answer.
Use your brain.
Yeah. And what people don't realize is when you ask a question, you're forcing somebody to see it from your point of view.
Right.
You can't do that by forcing it on them.
Yeah.
So the strategy is, and I go over this in the book.
Right.
So I said to my son, you have to establish with everybody has to agree on how does the transgender ideology work?
Right.
So I said, okay, so let me get this straight. This is kind of like gender is not tied to biology. Am I right?
Yeah.
No. I'm like, so, okay. So it's not tied to biology.
Okay.
And it's all about his feelings.
Of course.
It is right. And you're like, so if he feels like then he identifies that he's a woman.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm like, all right. So I said, so I got a couple questions for you. If your friend can identify as a woman and biology has no bearing, then that means that I could identify as being black. And he's like, of course, I'm a white heterosexual male. He's like, no. I'm like, yeah.
It's the same logic.
You set the rules.
Exactly.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I said, if everything about humanity is socially conditioned, I said, then I can identify as being black.
Yeah.
Well, he just about hit the roof. He's like, you can't do that. I'm like, well, I can. I said, so I'm black. I'm going to identify as being black. She said, well, now I'm going to identify as being a woman.
Yeah.
And I said, also, you know, I'm in my 50s. I've worked all my life. I've got a bad shoulder. I got a bad knee. I said, I have trouble waking up in the mornings. I said, I think I should be able to identify as being disabled. And he's like, I can't do that. And I said, well, look, if nothing is tied to my physical body, if gender or race isn't tied to my physical body, then neither is this. And I said, so what's to stop me from identifying as a disabled black woman and going up to Penn State because we're from State College. She said, going to Penn State and gaining affirmative action protections based upon these things. And he was livid. And I said, you set the rules. So what I did with him is I allowed that to sit.
Yeah.
And what I said to him was, we're not going to have any more conversations about this at all. Yeah. I love you, but no more conversations until you give me an answer that if your friend can identify as a woman, that I cannot identify as a disabled Black woman under these circumstances. And it spun him for, and then he'd be like, he's bringing up a social justice issue. I'd be like, no. You got to give me an answer. I want the answer. But then I also pushed him too. And I said, so do you realize, buddy, that if everything is socially conditioned, what about being a furry? So if it's all socially conditioned, right, and someone thinks that they're a cat trapped in a human body, I said, so let me ask you a question. If this stuff really goes and gets entrenched in culture, what if you have a son and he says, I'm a frog? Is society going to be forcing you to raise him like he is a frog at home? And he was like, and I'm like, well, think about it. How far does this go? If you want me to accept that your friend who is identifying as a woman is now a woman,
good,
I said, society can force you to raise your son on that. And I said, it gets even worse. And he was old enough to understand this.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, if everything about humanity is socially conditioned,
right,
if sexuality is socially conditioned,
yeah,
the minor attracted persons are using this very same logic to say our sexuality is socially conditioned, meaning that if you find a minor child that consents to having intimacy with an adult, that if it's all socially conditioned, you, and this is exactly the logic they're using. I said, you understand that? I said, what happens if you have a daughter who's 14 and she wants to have the relationship with a guy who's 25? I said, how are you going to stop them if this becomes entrenched in society?
Mm-hmm.
And we had these conversations over time.
Mm-hmm.
And he began to see the failure of it. Is this really the world that we want to live in? But the important part was I have a very good relationship with my sons.
Okay.
And we had set the groundwork through years of hanging out, having fun, mm-hmm, talking about sports. So you build the relationship, you use the ideologies against them, and when you ask the questions, over time, they're able to see,
right,
how they implode on, yeah, themselves.
Right. And is any deduction, for that matter, any argument that's built off of a deduction, mm-hmm, needs to have a stable framework as a fact.
Absolutely.
If it's not a fact, the entire argument should be disregarded because it's not built on truth. There's no basis for it actually being in reality. And the fact that you're asking questions about it, like the things like this, I'm putting his logic to the test. For me, that's what you do in those situations. But I think that you have to ask questions because that's the only way you can communicate with them.
Right.
Because if you don't ask questions, you get in the situation where they aren't going to be open to you anymore.
But absolutely. And that is so perceptive because what I could have done with my son is I could have looked at him and said,
right,
you can't do that because if he can do that, then I could do this. And why, you know, and if I would have gone that route, then what that does is he immediately goes like
that,
this.
Yeah.
But when you ask the question,
right,
the question forces an individual to, they can't even begin to formulate an answer until they've, right, accepted your premise.
Mm-hmm. And they have to look at it from your perspective.
And they have to look at it from your perspective. So the questions are absolutely critical. Now, you can do the same thing with critical race theory.
Right.
Yes. So many things you can do with critical race theory. So the way I try to equip people,
yep,
in this is to, it takes a little work because these are kind of complex ideas. They can,
yeah,
be understood. But what you want to be able to do is set them up, is to equip people so they can go in and have the preliminary conversation, then ask the right questions,
right,
and you let the questions do the work.
Right.
They let that process, because when you give them answers,
mm-hmm,
you know, I could show you how that works for critical race theory if you'd like, you know.
Oh.
But we did the same thing with critical race theory. Critical race theory says that society has been set up such a way to privilege white America and to disadvantage Black America. Now, the important part in this that we can't lose sight of is that Black America lags, but there's a disparity, significant disparity. Black America lags behind white America on every significant measure of success. It happens year after year. It's not good for the Black community. It's,
right,
not good for the white. It's not good for America. It's good,
exactly,
for nobody.
Yes.
So we really do need to solve and understand why.
Mm-hmm.
Though they say it's systemic racism that can't be overcome and these things, and it's been built into the system.
Mm-hmm. What they've done is they weaponized the causality of it.
Absolutely.
They've looked and they said, okay, well, there's a disparity here. But rather than looking at fact, they've used their own narrative to assign a...
They use the Marxist narrative, yeah, to assign that. And this is very dangerous. But if you know the facts, so here's some facts. So this is what I did. These are in the book, okay? They're footnoted in the book. So they like to cite the disparity between outcomes on SAT scores every year.
Right.
Okay, white, Black America lags behind Black America about 100 to 125 points every year on SAT scores.
Mm-hmm.
That's a significant, yeah, difference.
Mm-hmm.
The critical race theory is Marxist critical theory that says the test was written by white America, by white intellectuals, and they use cultural examples that Black America doesn't understand. They use vernacular,
mm-hmm,
in the questions. The English of the questions,
yeah,
is unfamiliar to Black America, and they set their math problems up in ways that's unfair. Well, so here's what you can do. There are three communities in America, I use one in the book, that outperform white America every,
right,
year. The first one are first immigrant Asian children. Now, the important part to understand about this is when Asian immigrants come over, they're generally, or these first generation are generally working class individuals.
Right.
So these kids' parents don't know much English, but many of them have not graduated from high school. They're working blue collar jobs, and they're also living within urban environments that the critical race theorists say can't be overcome. But they outperform white America every year. And so somebody analyzed this. I quote the book in my book. And what they said was, it's family structure. So when Asian families come to America, they totally understand the importance of education. Asian parents demand that their kids study.
Right.
You have two parents, you have structure in the house, and you have discipline, and they're like, you are going to study. And not only that, but the first immigrant Asian community bands together. If somebody is making more money than another family, and the family's child, this family who isn't making as much money, wants help preparing for the SAT, they'll pull resources as a community.
We should take notes from that. Yeah. Honestly, yeah, there's so much that we could do that would help.
Absolutely. It's family structure. Now, there's another one. Are you ready for this one? There's another community that outperforms the Asian American community, and you'll never guess who it is. They're West African immigrants.
Really?
Yes, West African immigrants. Now, they're black, they're indistinguishable from the African American community. They come to America, they're first generation immigrants.
Right.
They're black individuals living in urban environments, but it's still about family structure and expectation and discipline that they do. Now, they outperform white America and the Asian American community every year. Now, the immigrants from India fluctuate in their performance level. Then, are you ready for the final one if we have time? Are you ready for this one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And this is why education is so important.
Mm-hmm.
So critical race theorists say that part of the reason why black schools lag behind white America is they don't receive enough funding. White schools are getting more money per capita every year than black schools. When you look at New York City schools, that's not the case. New York City schools, when you adjust for urban environments, get more money than generally white rural schools do, okay? But this is the killer, and this comes from Thomas Sowell, if he's a black intellectual. There's a charter school called the Harlem Children's Zone that functioned for decades. Now, if you go to this high school in Harlem where the Harlem Children's Zone was, it's a multi-story building.
Yeah.
Now, we're used to having one-story schools out here, not there, multi-story building. So they put the Harlem Children's Zone on the upper floors of this failing high school in Harlem, but it's a charter school.
Yeah.
So they could hire the teachers they wanted, and the teachers weren't under the thumb of the unions. So they set this up so they had discipline for the kids. The kids came to school in uniforms, coats and ties for the boys and everything else. Uniforms, they had discipline, they had education. Now, here's what they did. These kids coming from the same neighborhoods as the failing school and the same building on the upper floors, they had a 90% placement in universities for these kids. Now, here's the thing that is utterly fascinating. When this was happening, they were accused of doing what they call cream skimming, that they went into the neighborhood and they found the best and the brightest kids, and not the kids from the really bad homes.
Yeah, yeah.
So what the Harlem Children's Zone did is they hired social workers to go all throughout the community, and they would find, even if a single parent that never graduated from high school, they would fill the form out, the application out for the kid, okay? They'd fill it out and they put it into a lottery system. So these kids were coming from the most disadvantaged homes on a lottery system, and they put them into the Harlem Children's Zone with discipline and expectation. And year after year, they graduated 90% of these kids into universities and in the same building that the critical race theorists said were failing because of systemic racism in Harlem that was failing because of systemic racism. And I would tie this into my kids and say, look, this is why marriage between a man and a woman, family structure, all of our biblical values are so critically important for civilization. And you could see this played out. And I would just say to my son, well, if critical race theory is the deal, how does the Harlem Children's Zone work? Do you understand why dad follows the Bible? So if you can spend some time working at it, you can be extremely successful with this.
That's amazing. I think the biggest thing that I think was a real eye-opener from what you just said, aside from the logical analysis that you do provide, is that you've looked at this and you've done the research, but you've understood that these arguments are flawed. Critical race theory, social justice, these are very flawed arguments, but you've come at it from a perspective as a father with your own kids that you have a relationship with. And rather than just, shouting at them and having them push you away, you actually took care to make sure that your relationship with them is still intact and actually made better by this conversation. Is there any advice that you would actually give to a parent that might be experiencing the same dilemma with their children? And what would you say is the best piece of advice in general that you would give to parents raising a child in this environment?
The first thing I would tell parents is your relationship with your children are your bond. And you can do a lot more through relating with your children than actually knowing how these ideologies necessarily work.
Right.
So if a parent is listening to this and they're going, I don't know what to do, my first thing is look at your kid and say, I want to do something with you.
Right.
Okay. Ask them what they want to do. As long as, if you don't like it, as long as it isn't illegal, try to figure out a way to get it done, because mm-hmm. that's what they like. And mm-hmm. so, meaning that you need to bond with your child. They will understand you love them when you spend time with them. Now, what you want to do is, when you first start out doing this, you got to do it on a weekly basis, on a daily basis. Connect with your children. Have conversations with them, but don't make it about social justice or anything else. You want to let the kid talk. And if the kid's into sports and you don't like sports, learn about his sports team. You don't have to be really invested, but you have to be able to have at least conversation where he can begin to tell you what is important to him and you listen. Mm-hmm. Work on building relationship with your children over time. Because what ends up happening is they need to trust you, because their friends are believing this and it's their social world. And right. if they cut away from their group and they're ostracized, they got to run to somebody.
Right.
And so you build trust with your children on that daily basis. Go spend time with them, relate to them, go get something to eat with them, find out what they like to do. Sometimes, you know, do what they like to do. Say, hey, let's do this together. You know,
right.
I was fortunate. I had two boys, you know, I mean, we went through basically, you know, we went to the range, we were hunted, we're outdoors, we're, you know, it's dad and his sons, you know, so it was good in terms of that.
Yeah.
But build relationship with your children. That's the very, very, very first place to start.
Okay. Well, I think that's pretty straightforward. But I think there's one thing that really is important to me as, you know, someone that is a son.
Sure.
But I think the biggest thing for me, and I have debate experience as well, I've come in contact with many questions where it's like, dang, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. That really makes me think about my argument differently. And I think it takes a certain humility to recognize when, yeah, my argument is wrong and it's based off of something that is flawed and logically or factually flawed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're definitely taking the right approach when it comes to this stuff. But I can definitely tell you for sure that questions are very, very efficient at just pointing out certain flaws in arguments. And I'm very happy that you've taken the time to write this book and that you're spreading the word about this. So
thank you. You know, part of it was for my own kids.
Yeah.
And you use this, you know, when you're debating somebody or public speaking or somebody has a difference of opinion, you're not going to see them again, you know, and I hate to maybe not, but these are my kids.
Right. Exactly.
And I was like, oh my goodness. But I can tell you this. I said, you just got to sit down and figure out what it is you need to do or whatever it is you have to do it. But even to this day, when I'm talking to my oldest son, my youngest son remembers a conversation, but we're all in the truck on the way home. Even to this day, when my son can talk about, my oldest son, I said, he'll go da da da, and I'm like, hey, I said, you remember the conversation? That one, you know, and he'll just nod his head like, yeah, I remember that one conversation. You know, and it was definitely the questions, you know, definitely the questions.
Yeah. And so. Yeah, put him in the hot seat.
Yeah.
Ask him the questions that need to be asked.
Right, and then you don't get angry at them. If they're going to spout off, you let them go. But then you say, but what the important thing to do is, look, we're not going to talk about any more of these social justice issues until you can give me a legitimate answer to this question. And you keep bringing them back to it and say, I don't see it. If you can do this, why can't I do this? And if you don't like this, why are you doing this in the first place? Mm-hmm. And so that becomes critical. So, but I mean, I'll put a little plug in for, I have a website, Battleground Ideas, a podcast there. And this is kind of what I do, is to break these ideas down, communicate them, let people know what's happening currently in culture, the perspectives from the church, what do we can do, what do we need to do, how do we respond, what direction is all this going? So I try to break all of this down as much as I possibly can on so many different levels.
Yeah.
So it isn't just about the book that I wrote for kids, which can be used by anybody.
Right.
But it's trying to create as many resources as I can.
Right. So if someone does want to buy the book that you have written, where should they go?
You can find it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can also go to my website, which is battlegroundideas.com. You can purchase it there, which is really where I'd recommend that people go, because if you found this conversation interesting, you'll find a ton of resources and articles there. I'm really just doing my best to equip people to fight the culture war. So the best place to really go is to the website, and you can email me if you've got any questions, comments, you can get in touch with me through there.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure having this conversation with you, and I wish you the best in your journey to fight this culture war and help people do the same.
Well, I thank you very much, Will. I thank everybody at the radio station here on WFYL, because you got the courage to do this, because I can tell you, a lot of churches, a lot of pastors, a lot of, you know, Christian radio, they're like, I'm not sure what we're going to do about this. This is, we don't understand, but I want to thank you for what you're doing, because we've all got to begin to step up. I mean, the culture war isn't, I always say, we haven't lost a culture war, we really never fought. You know,
exactly.
We really never fought.
Yeah.
And all it takes is getting some education and just stepping out to engage. And you can find some great results. So thank you all for your ministry and what you're doing.
All right. Thank you so much for having this conversation.
You're very welcome. Thank you. God bless you.
All right, you too. God bless.
Bye.